This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 102. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
Doing good. We got some really cool new reviews of the show in iTunes. C. Snipes said, every episode is a gem. He said, this podcast is dense with valuable experience and insight, especially for small and early career tech entrepreneurs. Mike and Rob are experienced, personable, down-to-earth guys. Conversations are focused and relevant. And then Don Felker said, best startup podcast. He said, it's one of the best podcasts I've listened to in years. Great, simple advice for micropreneurs and single founders. I highly advise listening to it. You know, Mike, when I'm down and sad and all alone, I go into iTunes and I read our reviews. It makes me feel good, man. It makes me feel good that we can talk to people. That we can talk to each other, but that it resonates with people and that, you know, that they get value out of what we're saying on the show.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. I love getting the emails from people, whether it's just praise or people asking questions and just sending things our way. So that's really great to hear. Definitely want to say thanks to everybody for all that support.
Yeah, it says a lot about our listenership. Our listenership is smaller than, you know, some major podcasts like Mixergy or This Week in Startups. We rank really well for the term startups, and we have per listener, I think we have a lot more ratings and reviews in iTunes. So It's very cool. How about you? What's going on this week?
Well, I'll be in Brooklyn over the next couple of months quite a bit. Probably 5 of the next 9 weeks I'll be spending in Brooklyn, New York. So if anyone's interested in meeting up, just drop me a line. You can shoot me an email, either questions at startupsforrestofus.com or Mike at micropreneur.com. Either one will get to me. And we'll just kind of schedule a time and meet up, or just shoot me a message on Twitter or whatever.
Very cool. I am speaking on the Google campus this weekend. I'm speaking at a Google developer event that's designed to get developers together and get them fired up about using like Google APIs and maps and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, I thought they were going to be replacing Marissa Mayer with you.
Yeah, that's what it is. Wouldn't I do a great job of that?
Of course.
They'd say, just stand there and look gorgeous. And I'd say, oh. Yeah, in terms of the speaking gig at Google, I was actually reticent to do it. I was invited a couple months ago by a guy here in Fresno who had seen me speak. And you know, as a rule, I don't enjoy speaking at developer events because when I say things like the code doesn't actually matter that much and the idea it doesn't actually matter that much, it's a lot about marketing. They don't tend to want to hear that. So I'm not like a popular guy. And it's not even about being popular. I don't feel like it resonates with them because they, you know, in general, developers don't want to hear that message. So it took some convincing, but frankly, I've never been to the Google campus there in Mountain View. So I really wanted to be convinced to go do it. And since it's, you know, a talk I've given before that he said would resonate with the crowd and he knows the crowd. And frankly, it's only 40 minutes. So no matter how bad it goes, I can flop pretty bad for 40 minutes and still feel okay about it.
Cool. On my end, I've lost a couple of Altiris training subscribers, which is a little bit sad and unfortunate, but one of them actually didn't drop from being a subscriber so much as they tried it out, and it was the first person who tried it and said, no, we're going to actually pass on it, so we're going to take a refund, which is a little disappointing, but some of the content isn't there that they were looking for, and they were very adamant about me staying in touch with them so that when the content is there that they'll check it out again. So that was at least good to see. But they, you know, had high praise for the content that was there. It just wasn't particularly relevant for what they were using.
Oh, interesting. So you need to add more content then if you want to keep customers like them around?
Yeah, it's just they were looking for more advanced content, and a lot of the stuff that's there right now is for beginners, and you just can't find some of this stuff online. I mean, you can find it, but it's a lot like the Academy. You know, it's not like there's anything in the Academy that you can't find elsewhere, but it's highly consolidated into one location, so you don't have to go looking for it, and you can get your questions answered very concisely and very quickly. And what they're looking for is just some topics that I haven't even touched on or talked about yet. So that was fine. It was the first person who said, hey, you know, this just isn't going to work for us.
Right. So do you think you're going to invest some time into adding more content and keeping them around?
Well, these people are already gone. So once I develop, I can develop about half the content that they want. The other half, I don't actually have the ability to do because I've never actually done some of that stuff that they were asking for. So I have to figure out how I'm going to address that issue. And I've got some ideas. I've got some consultants I could probably lean on or some other partners that I could talk to and say, hey, can I pay you to put together some videos for this or that? And it might cost me a couple $100 to have them put together some videos that are some overviews or some detailed descriptions of how to actually solve certain problems. But a couple of subscribers would completely offset that those costs.
Right. Did you see the thread on Quora? It was about what are the most ridiculous technology patents ever granted?
No, I didn't.
And it ties in a little bit with our discussion last week. Someone mentioned some of the things we mentioned last week, like Amazon's one-click patent, the pull to refresh feature present in many apps. They said it's actually patented by Twitter. Making links in an email clickable. They say all links and phone numbers and emails can be made clickable even when the original email sent by the user didn't make them clickable links. Sounds trivial, but Apple patented it and they sued HTC over the patent, which is kind of frightening. Isn't that crazy? Buying stuff inside an app. They said, yep, even if an app says click here to buy the full version, they are infringing a patent. Rovio got sued over this by Loadsys, which owns the patent. And I'm pretty sure Loadsys is one of, you might call them patent trolls. They aren't actually building anything. They just own a big portfolio of patents and they make their money by suing people for it. So, and there are a few others. There's none I hadn't really heard of before that are that surprising.
I'm surprised about the Loadsys patent where you have to click here to buy the full version. I mean, doesn't that blast out of the water the entire shareware industry from like the 90s? And wouldn't that patent have expired by now? Or couldn't you point to the entire, like pretty much all of the 90s as being one of those situations where it's like, oh, well, there's past examples of where this already existed, so it can't be patentable?
I'm sure the lawyers tried. Rovio definitely has them. So I bet it's only dealing with a mobile app or something to that effect.
Oh, maybe.
You know what I'm saying? I'm sure there's a loophole because they, I mean, you can read the VentureBeat article and it looks like Rovio had a heck of a time with them. So it certainly was not as easy as saying, hey, there was prior art.
I saw something else. It was Rackspace and Red Hat are in staunch opposition to any software patents. And we've kind of talked about this before, but you know, they're completely against software patents of any kind. And it was surprising to see that Rackspace had come out so strongly against it. I mean, I kind of understand why, but it's interesting that those are the only two major companies that have kind of thrown their names in along those lines.
Right. Well, and there's been a bunch of things floating around Silicon Valley of Paul Graham and Y Combinator said, we're going to agree not to sue. Like, even if we patent something, we're not going to do offensive litigation. I think Twitter had said that they weren't going to use their portfolio for offensive stuff, only for defense. I mean, it's pretty crazy. There weren't software patents until 1998. It was only copyrightable before then. And so we definitely have existed without software patents. And anything else going on with you?
Yeah, I suppose an episode wouldn't be complete without an Audit Shark update. But I've talked about my database synchronization issues in the past, and I had somebody from Microsoft contact me who said that they thought that I was using some software that they wrote. So that was really cool to see. But I'm finally at the point where after 3,700 lines of SQL code and another 2,000 lines of C# code, I'm finally able to synchronize the databases, or at least I have the databases in a state where I can synchronize them. I still can't do it natively through my code, but I've got other tools that can synchronize between them so I can actually get started with building policies and pushing them out to the cloud so that people can use them at this point. So I'll be starting on building those this week, and then hopefully by Monday people will be able to start using them.
Right. So what does that mean in terms of that? So that's the technical side of it. What does it mean in terms of like the users that you have using it?
It means my entire schedule has been pushed back by like 6 weeks because of this problem.
So you're going to be back where you kind of were 6 weeks ago before this thing cropped up, and then you're going to resume. You're going to continue with your early access users and hopefully get a few more on board in the next couple weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very good. I was looking at a list of marketing tasks. I keep going back to that Hittail marketing plan that I wrote up about, 9 months ago. It expanded for a while, and then, boy, for the past couple of months, it's really been, I mean, it's a huge plan, right? It's like 12 pages long. I've mentioned it before. And I keep just plucking ideas off of it and implementing them as they strike my fancy. You know, it's like, well, I want to do that. I'm going to try that out and see how it works. And some of them have worked and some of them haven't. I made a list. I started reordering them this weekend, and I just put them into three different categories, like the more traffic bucket, the higher conversions bucket, and the higher lifetime value bucket. And looking at them in this way was really eye-opening, because suddenly I realized that when you first launch an app, it's all about more traffic, right? Because you have zero visitors, you know, and you want to get to 500, 1,000, 2,000 just so you can start seeing patterns, so you can get some customers. I mean, it's just such a scramble to get that initial flywheel of traffic going. And then at the point now, I don't actually need to do any of the more traffic things right now for Hittail, because I have plenty of traffic coming through that now needs to be optimized. So almost everything that I'm picking off the list now is either to increase conversion rates, whether from visits to trials, trials to paid, or to increase the lifetime value of customers. So the more traffic stuff's going on the back burner now, and everything else is moving forward. But I think depending on where your business is at, you know, if you're listening to this, like, give that some thought. It's not always about traffic. It's not always about conversions. It will bounce back and forth between these two things. And almost for sure, if I get this converting really well and dramatically increase it over the next couple of months, I'm then going to want to go back and I'm going to want to double my traffic again. Right? Because then you can just take even more advantage of the higher conversion rates that you're getting.
Yeah, that's very cool. I mean, I hadn't necessarily thought about breaking those into, you know, all the marketing tasks into the different results that you're expecting to get from them, but it does make sense.
So this week, Mike, we're talking about four levels of income-generating web apps. And this outline is actually inspired by a recent episode. I was listening to the podcast Internet Business Mastery, and they looked at four levels of niche websites. And the way, you know, they're into the more like knowledge marketing, information marketing stuff. And so he looked at having a niche website and then an affiliate website and then building an authority website and then building kind of a personal brand website. So nothing to do with software. But as I listened to it, I realized there are similar levels or tiers of web apps. So I kind of wanted to run through and give my recommendations, our recommendations on where we think you should start, the pluses and minuses, and some questions you should ask yourself to determine which level you might want to choose first and go through it from there. So again, there are four levels. We're going to be running through them. Before we do that, I actually wanted to make an honorable mention. It's level zero. And this is, I've owned several sites like this that are not technically web apps, but they're more just niche websites like AdSense sites, affiliate sites, smaller content sites that just get traffic via like SEO or affiliate traffic or some kind of flywheel traffic that continues to come every month and get really cheap visitors that come. And so you don't need a high lifetime value to make a decent amount of recurring income. And while this is not a web app, so I don't want to include it in our four levels, I did want to mention this as something that I've seen people cut their teeth and learn internet marketing doing this kind of site. Examples of this site, there's one, we'll include these in the show notes, but one of them is scootersmopedscyclesreview.com, and the other one is whatsthebest-mattress.com. This gives you an example, and these are not great examples. I don't own these sites. These are just random sites I found, but this gives you an idea of what like a really niche site is and how you can go into such a tiny niche with such low competition that you can just create some content around that and instantly rank in a search engine and get enough traffic to make a few bucks a month that can then be used to maybe fund, you know, ideas down the line. And I don't know if you've done that. I've definitely done that. I had some niche sites that were making $400 or $500 a month, which is not, you know, it's not like, wow, I'm going to quit my job money, but I could use that money, especially early on. That helped me quit consulting with, along with some other, you know, sites I had. And it also helped fund some development and some of the advertising on, you know, some CMS Themer and some other early websites I had. I'm going to dive into number one. It's the first level of income generating web apps. And this first level is a low competition niche application. So it's a low competition web app that's in a tight niche. So the thought behind this is you could almost use another word for it. It could be like an entrenched web app, a web app that has a good source of traffic, either from something like SEO or from affiliates or from, you know, WordPress.org searches, or it could even be, if it's a mobile app and not a web app, it could even be just from the app store, but it's some type of recurring, quite a bit of traffic, something where you don't need a high lifetime value to support it. And so, frankly, any iPhone app that gets a decent chunk of traffic through the iOS app store could be called a low competition niche app because there's not a lot of competition you're trying to fight off. I own a couple apps like this. Wedding Toolbox is like that. The entire market is not very big. The competition, it does not tend to be that brutal, right? It's not like I need to go out and do all types of infographics and hardcore in-person marketing and heavy sales in order to keep Wedding Toolbox as a profitable app. And then another example I thought of was Dave Rodenbaugh's WordPress plugin, AWPCP, which is another WordPress classified plugin. And again, it's low competition. He gets traffic through Google and WordPress.org, and it is in a small niche. And these are great. Now, these are don't tend to be I'm going to quit my job apps. You don't tend to make 10 grand a month off of these things. They tend to be very stable and consistent, and you can build up a nice flywheel of traffic, and they can either help fund larger ideas, or if you combine a few of them together, they can be really good at helping you essentially quit your job and gain the freedom you've probably been looking for.
The nice thing about these types of things is it is very similar to the honorable mention that you talked about earlier, which was just using those to kind of cut your teeth on internet marketing and learn the things that you really need to know in order to essentially take your future products to the next level. So it's really hard to jump into something as large as, you know, Hittail or a lot of these other applications and just jump in feet first and go with it without necessarily knowing anything, because you're going to make a lot of mistakes, and you know, you don't necessarily want to make a lot of those mistakes early on, or at least you want to minimize them as much as possible so as not to waste your opportunities.
Exactly. That's a good point about learning internet marketing from a simpler idea with lower competition, because you can learn a lot and then apply that later on to more competitive apps. The low competition niche app is what we talk a lot about in the academy. I mean, this is where we're trying to get people in and having, you know, some type of success early on. It builds confidence, and it teaches those early skills that they can then use to leverage into, potentially if they want, to leverage into larger niches. So the second level of income-generating web apps is a competitive niche app. So first level was low competition niche app. This is a competitive niche app. So this is something that needs more active marketing than in a low competition niche. So examples of this do include, like you mentioned, Hittail. It's not just going to have this simple flywheel of traffic coming in. It's going to need more active marketing to grow. Plugio, Justin Vincent's app, is a good example. Buffer app, anything in a hot niche like Twitter client or anything like that, it's definitely going to be competitive. Frankly, BidSketch by Ruben Gomez, which is proposal. When it first launched, it was proposal software made for designers. So it was a niche app, but it was a competitive niche. And it wasn't a huge market. And for the first year or 15 months or so, he really aimed after that. And then he actually made the leap into the next level, you know, that we'll talk about in a second.
So the third one is a competitive large market, and examples of applications that fall into the competitive large market are things like Hootsuite or Radian6, other applications like Salesforce. And that's a very large market for CRM software, but it's also very competitive. You know, there's a lot of customizations that can be done. There's a lot of different players. The market tends to be very fragmented, but there's also a lot of money to be had here because there are so many customers out there who can use a CRM. Other applications are things like HubSpot, which has a very large horizontal market, and HubSpot is used primarily to gain inbound marketing. And then you've got things like Stripe, which is used for taking credit cards from people. And Stripe is in a very competitive market as well. I mean, there are tons of different players out there like Chargeify, Recurly, and all these other different billing services that will allow you to accept payments on behalf of you. And then there's also things like we just mentioned BidSketch being in a competitive niche, but now BidSketch is more in a large market that is competitive, and there's a much higher growth curve to that, much higher, I'll say, ceiling to where BidSketch could go as opposed to where it could have gone 12 or 18 months ago.
Right. And there's certainly some overlap here. Like, you know, I mentioned Plugio and Buffer as competitive niche apps, right? They're in like level two. And one could argue that they should be in level three because it's a larger market. But I'm actually saying that they cater to a kind of a vertical niche within Twitter apps, whereas Hootsuite and Radian6, they're like a horizontal Twitter app, right? So big market, and they kind of try to be everything to everybody, whereas Plugio and Buffer are very specific things. It's like purely for buffering your tweets, purely for scheduling your tweets. It doesn't do all the fancy stuff that the bigger guys do. And frankly, you know, you could argue the same thing with Hittail. Like Hittail, I consider it to be in a fairly competitive niche. It's a vertical. It really is towards search engine optimizers. It's towards internet marketers, people who understand digital marketing. You could say that's a large market, but it's not a horizontal tool like HubSpot, right? Which is it's also online marketing, but it's just way, way bigger. It's a much larger market. And as a result, if you enter into a competitive large market, you either better really, really know what you're doing, or you better have a ton of money backing you up. And aside from BidSketch, every app on this list has millions, if not tens of millions of dollars that they've raised to compete in these markets. And to be honest, there is a range here. The Hootsuite market is obviously larger than BidSketch's market. I mean, in terms of just the sheer number of people who would potentially use it. So there's definitely a range even within each of these levels. But again, the competitive large market is not something that you can just dive into as a newbie. And I think a lot of people make that mistake. I know I did early on by choosing ideas that were in these horizontal markets and just figuring, if these guys can make it work, so can I. But these guys have way more experience than you, and they've either launched apps successfully, grown apps successfully, or they have just a huge amount of money backing them up, and they can make a lot of mistakes.
I feel like a lot of developers fall into the trap of going after the competitive large market because they look at these other products that are out there and say, oh, well, that piece of software sucks. I could build something very similar. It would be 10 times better. And the things that come to mind are things like service desk software or any sort of CRM or bug tracking. And
project management.
Yeah,
QuickBooks project management. Type stuff. Yeah,
exactly. And it seems like it would be easy to build something that would be competitive. And it's really about the marketing at that point. It's not about the product.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned that for a lot of developers make the mistake of going into level three. I think a lot of devs and just a lot of people in general make the mistake of also going into level four, which is we're calling the disruptive apps. And these are basically the moonshot, luckshot, lottery try apps like Facebook, Twitter, Google, Pinterest, basically anything that doesn't really have a revenue model and that you definitely need to raise funding to get off the ground. Basically, something that really doesn't tend to be sold on value. It's going to tend to disrupt, and it's going to be 1 in 1,000 that might work, or 1 in 5,000. I mean, just a very, very long shot. Whereas if you go into a low competition niche app, that level one we just talked about, seriously, like 1 in 10, 1 in 5, if you get good at it, maybe even better, 1 in 3, really good odds, but it's the payoff is just not tremendous. But to a single person, if you're trying to quit your job or you just want to make a car payment or a house payment, like that actually has a big impact on your life. But we don't see that, right? When we watch the tech news or we read, Inc. and Fast Company, and they're talking about the disruptive apps. That's what everybody wants to talk about. And so we, who are in the startup space tend to be to gravitate towards this disruptive app mythos.
And I think the thing to point out about the disruptive apps is that it's disruptive the first time primarily because there isn't a business model there. Like before, when Google was first getting started, everyone looked at all these different search apps, and I think that there were 13 of them, or there were 12 on the market already, and Google was the 13th. And at the time, there was no business model there for search engines. There just wasn't. And somebody took a chance on them, and they went forward with it, and eventually they figured out, oh, well, we can do advertising in here, and if we do good enough at search, we can get paid advertisements embedded into the search results. And now if you look at something like DuckDuckGo, which is kind of headed up by Gabriel Weinberg, that you might point to and say, well, is that a disruptive app? And I would almost argue that it is not, because there is a known business model that fits that is going to generate revenue. Whereas 12 years ago, when Google was first getting started, there was no specific business model. They didn't know how they were going to make money. Whereas with DuckDuckGo, they have a decent idea. And I know that they're not going in the direction of specifically selling advertisements in line with all of their search results. They're going in a slightly different direction. But they at least have an idea of how they're going to be making money. Whereas with Google, the plan was not to make money. They wanted to build it as quickly as possible, get as large as possible, and then figure it out. So that's really kind of what separates, the disruptive apps versus a lot of these other ones, because with the disruptive apps, they don't know how they're going to make money until they get to a point where they say, okay, well, this is the direction we're going to go. They just don't have those ideas up front.
And when we talk about these four levels of income generating web, and I should say mobile apps, because they kind of fit into this as well, what we really mean by level is like level of difficulty. So given those four levels, put together a couple questions that you should ask yourself to figure out which level you should choose. Because once you've decided on a level, it becomes a lot easier to choose ideas that fit within that mark and that are going to be more geared towards your level of expertise at the time. So we have four questions. And the first one is, are you looking for side income or are you looking to ultimately have full-time income? And even if you say, I'm looking to have ultimately have full-time income, you could still choose something in, you know, the level one, which is that low competition niche app, because you can combine several of them together. I mean, that's originally how I built the full-time income. And I've since kind of transitioned, not out of that, because I still own a lot of apps, but I have some apps that would now provide full-time income on their own. So to get you started, start thinking, am I happy with my job? And I do want to stay here for a few years. And I'm really just looking to get a side income with kind of the minimum amount of work. Then you should definitely think about level one. And if you really are headstrong to get out of your job as soon as possible, then it's probably a better thing to think about heading into level two or thinking about tackling level ones, you know, several of them in series, not at the same time, but one after another.
The second question to ask yourself is, do you have a concrete idea or do you need to dive in and figure out what's working and then double down on it? And the idea behind this question is really figuring out whether you know exactly what it is that you want to do, or do you want to try a couple of different things, see what's working, and then head hard in that direction. And if you're not really sure, you can try a couple of different things that are in that low competition, and maybe they'll grow from there into, you know, the level two. Because I almost feel like a lot of these, when you're going from level one to level two to level three, the difficulty is essentially synonymous with the payoff as well. I mean, in the low competition, you're making much less money than you would in something that's a level two, which is a competitive niche app. And these things, you have to figure out where you want to start. What level are you comfortable attacking first and progressing from there?
Third question we have is, how much time do you have on a weekly basis to devote to the idea? And how much money do you have to fund it? Because obviously, level three and level four are just an entirely different order of magnitude than one and two. So it's really something that you need to think about. If you're going to work part-time outside of your job and you just have, you know, $100 or a few hundred bucks a month to put into it, then you really, I mean, I would honestly recommend starting with a level one, maybe a level two. But I think that's even where, like, starting with level two, if you've never had a success and you're just trying to learn the marketing, it can become frustrating pretty quickly, because without the resources to experiment boldly, your learning is going to take a long time. You know, you either need to be able and willing to pay for education through actually learning it yourself through the hard knocks, or you need to be willing to pay for it through like online classes. And that kind of stuff will shortcut you and it will get you, you know, ahead of where you are if you just learned it by yourself. But it still does, it absolutely requires quite a bit of time on an ongoing basis to do a level two or above. Whereas level one is just tends to be more of a upfront investment, and then you can tend to put it on autopilot and move on to your future ideas and use that to then fund those.
I think that's a key that you just touched on, which is being able to put something on autopilot, because a lot of these other ones, once you get above level one into level two and level three, you really can't put it on autopilot. You really have to keep on top of it and make sure that you're continuing to try and move the business forward, because if you start slacking off at all, your business is going to, in some cases, it'll nosedive. In other cases, it'll just simply taper down over time as you neglect it. And the fourth thing to ask yourself is, have you successfully executed with online marketing in the past? And if you are just starting out, you've never built a product before and never tried to bring a product to market completely on your own. And I do want to point out that this is completely different than being on a team of 10 or 15 people and then pushing product out the door as part of a software company. When you're doing everything yourself, it is a completely different story to try and tackle a large market versus trying to do it yourself. I mean, there's worlds of difference in terms of experience with online marketing than if you're coming from just a programming background. So although it may look easy, it really isn't. Having some of that background and some of that experience is definitely going to help you. So if you've never done it before, you're much better off starting in level one or level two so that you do get that experience and you can build up to go after a level three if that's ultimately what your goal is.
Yeah, I heard an interview, I think it may have been with Dan Martell. He made the statement that once you've started a company, like a $1 million company that has $1 million in annual revenue, if you sell that or you otherwise exit, that you never want to do that again. because now you want to go for a $10 million or $100 million company. And that actually resonated quite a bit. I think that's something to be noted here, is that while you don't have to move up these levels, once you've gained the experience, and depending on your personality, if you really do want to continue learning, you will kind of master these levels. I certainly feel like I got bored in the low competition niche apps and moved into the more competitive niches. And I've known several other entrepreneurs who are doing the same, who are just, but it's just that you've done it a few times and there's kind of nothing new to learn. And I think as developers who are, you know, fairly intelligent people, you want to continue to learn and expand your horizons, and that don't feel like since you start in level one, that that's where you need to stay, or that's even where you're going to want to stay past having the first few successes.
I think part of it's just wanting to be challenged and fulfilled in your job or in your career. Nobody wants to do the same thing over and over. So starting out at level one and then progressing from there is, it seems to me like it's a natural progression. I could see people who want to live a specific lifestyle and they just want to stay in that level one or level two area where they don't necessarily need to stay on top of things all the time, or they can shift their focus away from it and live their life and have it as a lifestyle business versus something where they have to continuously stay on top of it, work 40 hours a week, continue to do it day in and day out in order to continue making that business a success.
So those are our thoughts on four levels of income generating web apps. If you have other thoughts or questions, obviously feel free to post them on the blog or send them to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. We actually got a few more questions this week. They seem to be piling up, Mike. I think we're going to have to do more Q&A episodes here soon. We got another drinking game submission from Micah Alcorn. Thanks for that. He says that the quote is, "People should drink whenever we get a question that says, I'm a business guy with a brilliant idea. How do I find a technical co-founder?" I like that one. And the cool part is he says, by the way, I am a business guy with too many ideas. My solution is to learn to write code on nights and weekends, build prototypes, test hypotheses, and then outsource. Well, thanks, Micah.
Well, I got a couple of comments from people as well via email. One of them was from a guy from Microsoft who apparently realized that I was using some code that he's written to synchronize the databases. So he said that if I ever needed anything or had any questions, just let him know. So I'll definitely hit him up for that. And then another one was from Scott, who had a specific question for me about Audit Shark. And he said, "Hi, Mike, I was listening to the podcast this morning and you talked about the appeal Audit Shark has for those who've been hacked. A friend of mine works for Core Security, which is a Boston company that does penetration and security testing for enterprises. What do you think about companies like Core as a reseller or recommender for Audit Shark? Great show. Thanks for putting all the effort in, Scott." And I wrote him back, and I basically told him that in order for me to sign on multiple resellers for a product like Audit Shark, I think that would be a pretty big challenge for me right now. And not necessarily in terms of time, but I think that early on, it would be really difficult because there's a lot of different things that go into it. I feel like long term, it's a viable strategy. But when you're early on, the problem is that you have to be able to justify what type of market there is for the product and provide the prospective partners with enough guidance about how to reach their audience effectively, how they can sell it, what types of companies are good fits for the particular product. They really need to know what the level of work, risk, and reward is that they're undertaking. And that's really hard to gauge when you're first starting out with a product. So I would be hard pressed to provide a lot of those details to somebody. Those are a lot of good questions, and I don't necessarily know the answers to those yet. The really big one is that how much time and training is it going to take to get that partner up to speed on the product? And how do you keep multiple partners from stepping on each other when they're going after the sales? And, you know, just an example of that is, let's say that I give everybody a 25% discount on the software. Well, each of them is going to start competing and using the MSRP and drop it down up to 25%. And they're going to each try and maintain their own margins. And you would think that when these partners are trying to compete against each other for, let's say, the same account, that, you know, they're going to either run into these cases where they say, well, you know, I've got a better relationship with you, so, you know, you'll buy from me. And that's not generally the case. I mean, a lot of times what will happen is customers will buy from whoever gives them the cheapest price, which is why Dell is as large as they are, because they sell pretty much every product you could possibly imagine. And if you go to Dell's website or you call Dell, I guarantee you that they will sell you just about any given software product out there. You know, just look at the Fortune 1000, look at all the software companies, and I can almost guarantee that Dell will sell every single one of their products. And the reason is because Dell just does so much volume that they are able to get these giant discounts from various software vendors. So when you have that type of relationship, what you're doing is you're putting the partners in an uncomfortable position where they're competing against each other. And that makes things really hard, because those large customers, those large value-added resellers, even if they don't actually add value to the deal, sometimes they'll do things like they'll bundle hardware and software together, and they won't necessarily differentiate between what the costs are. And it looks like the customer's getting a great deal, and they may or may not be, but what ultimately ends up happening is that they end up pushing the other resellers out of the deal. So then they're essentially destroying your reseller channel. So those are a lot of the things that you have to be careful of. There's one reseller now that I'm working with that is somebody that I have a really good relationship, because we share a lot of core values and beliefs about how to run our business. But for me, I think it's more a matter of starting out really slow and picking the right partners, as opposed to just trying to get as many partners as possible and then working out the kinks so that it can be ramped up effectively. Going down the road of resellers is something I'm looking at, but it's not necessarily I'm going to go in this direction and go as fast as possible. It's really about working out the kinks, trying to figure out what's wrong, what's right, what is and is not going to work. And then once I figure out all that stuff, then kind of ramp it up.
Right. We hear a lot from different surveys and studies of startups that premature scaling was one of the biggest causes of startup failure. And in my opinion, trying to find resellers at this point would be far premature. And I think it's pretty obvious you still need to develop more features, really get that product market fit, problem solution fit. I mean, find that product that people are dying to have. And then once you're doing well selling them one-on-one, then you start developing that reseller channel. Beyond that, I've done some reseller stuff and affiliate stuff, and it is quite a bit of effort. It's a lot more effort than people realize in terms of exactly what you said. It's like training, getting them on board, getting them pumped up, reminding them they're supposed to be selling your stuff, handling issues, who, you know, do they do support, do you do support? There's more to it than just finding some people and having them magically sell a bunch of copies of your software every year. So I don't see it as much of a silver bullet as I think I've heard people mention. So those are two things to keep in mind.
Well, I think that the one thing to point out about that is that most people look at affiliate sales and they say, oh, well, resellers will make 30 or 40 or 50% or something like that, because that's a typical margin on a lot of those affiliate deals. But when partners have sales reps involved and they're actively trying to sell those, they're going to start cutting into their commissions in order to make the sale. So then they're competing against each other. And I've seen situations where even on 6- and 7-figure deals, the commission is only about 2% of the total sale. So you take a $1 million deal and 2% of that is about $20,000. It is not that much with regards to the size of the deal. And $20,000, it sounds like a lot, but the reality is how long is it going to actually take you to land a $1 million sale? And it's not going to be overnight. It's going to be several months. So if you spent several months trying to land one deal and you get $20,000 out of it, was it worth it at the end of the day? And for the partners, many times the answer is no, it just isn't. So that's something you really have to keep in mind when you start ramping up the partners. When you only have one, those issues are just non-existent. You don't have to worry about them. But when you have 10 or 100 or 1,000, it's a completely different story.
So if you have a question for us and you'd like to hear us discuss it on the show, you can call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.